Hi everyone, my name is Mr. Barlow, and welcome to episode 35 of the VCE Biology Podcast. This episode covers part of Unit 4, Area of Study 1, and I'll be talking about some of the tools geneticists use in their work, as well as the uses of some DNA technologies. So if you went up to a geneticist and asked them what they do every day, some of them may very well respond with, "I play with DNA." And that's what they do, they manipulate DNA. But of course DNA is a very small molecule, so you can't just take a hammer and chisel to it to do what you want to do with it. Geneticists actually have to use molecular tools to manipulate DNA. So an example of a molecular tool to manipulate DNA is a restriction enzyme. So restriction enzymes can basically cut DNA into fragments. And there's a whole bunch of different types and they're specific. So one restriction enzyme is specific and it cuts at a particular stretch of DNA. It cuts at a recognition sequence. For example, HIND3 cuts at AAGCTT. And that's where it cuts DNA into two different fragments. So some restriction enzymes cut the DNA straight down, cut both fragments, straight down between two base pairs. And if they do that, they leave what's called a blunt end. But some restriction enzymes, for example, like HIND3, cuts DNA, the double-stranded DNA, so that it leaves a sticky end. And what happens here is one strand of DNA is left kind of overhanging when the restriction enzyme cuts it. So if you're a geneticist and you want to cut some DNA, you use a restriction enzyme. Now, if you've got a whole bunch of DNA fragments and you want to separate them according to their size or their lengths, then what you need to do is you need to use a process called electrophoresis. So electrophoresis works by basically putting a bunch of DNA of different sizes at one end of a gel and then applying an electric current to the gel. What happens then is DNA has an overall negative charge. So when you apply an electric current to a gel, the DNA will move towards the positive electrode or the positive end of the gel. So the negative DNA will move towards the positive end of the gel. But what will happen is the smaller fragments of DNA will move through the gel faster than the larger fragments of DNA. So after you've applied an electric current to the gel for a period of time, you'll be able to stop it, and then at one end of the gel you'll have the smaller fragments of DNA, and at the other end of the gel you'll have the larger fragments of DNA. And that's how you separate DNA according to size or length, which is the same thing when we're talking about DNA, and that's electrophoresis. Now another tool that genetic engineers use is what's called a probe. So a probe is what you use if you want to find a piece of DNA. And a probe is actually just a single-stranded piece of DNA, and it's got a base sequence which is complementary to the base sequence of the strand of DNA that you want to find. So what you do then is you mix your probe with either a group of cells or some fragments of DNA that you've cut. And the probe, which is either labelled with a radioactive marker or a fluorescent marker, it will then bind to the piece of DNA that you're interested in, and then you can analyse those cells or the collection of DNA fragments, and the probe will show you exactly where that DNA sequence is that you're interested in. So you might be looking for a particular sequence of DNA on a chromosome, you don't know which chromosome it's on. So you mix a probe with some cells, and then that probe will show you that, the DNA sequence you're interested in is on chromosome 12 or something. So as I said before, sometimes genetic engineers want to cut DNA, and they use restriction enzymes to do that. But other times they want to join strands of DNA together. So if they want to do that, they use an enzyme which is known as ligase. And ligase catalyzes the joining of a piece of double-stranded DNA together at the sugar phosphate backbone. So if you've got two bits of DNA and you want to join them together, use a special enzyme called a ligase. Now, sometimes scientists want to insert a bit of DNA, like a gene, into a cell which doesn't have that gene. And to do that, they use special carriers or vectors. So a good example of a vector is a plasmid. And a plasmid is a little circular piece of DNA, which exists in bacterial cells. So what you can do is you can get a plasmid, you can cut it with a restriction enzyme, you can then get the DNA sequence or the gene that you're interested in, mix that with the cut, which has been cut with the same restriction enzyme, mix that with the plasmid, then using ligase, join the new gene with the cut plasmid, so then you've got this circular plasmid, which has got the normal plasmid DNA, but also the new gene you're interested in, and then insert that plasmid, circular chromosome, circular bit of DNA, back into the bacterial cell, and then ta-da, you've introduced a gene into a cell which didn't used to have that gene. So plasmids can be really useful for scientists, and they're a great example of a vector. So that's a bunch of ways that scientists can manipulate DNA if they want to. But of course, if you want to manipulate a little bit of DNA, you've got to get a hold of that little bit of DNA first. So how do you do that? Well, there's a couple of ways. I mean, you can run some DNA fragments through electrophoresis and then get the little bit you want. Or there's a special machine called a DNA synthesizer. So you can synthesize or, fabricate a new piece of DNA. You can also make a copy of the DNA using a messenger RNA template, using a special enzyme called reverse transcriptase. So if you've got the messenger RNA template that you want, you mix the appropriate nucleotides and the enzyme reverse transcriptase, and then a single-stranded DNA copy is called, and that single-strand bit of DNA is known as copy DNA. So sometimes scientists want to create multiple copies of a whole gene, or even they want to be able to create huge volumes of the protein that that gene encodes for. So to do that kind of thing, what you do is you use a process called gene cloning. And to do that, you get the gene in question, and then you insert that gene into a plasmid, and then of course you put that plasmid DNA into a bacterial cell, and then that bacterial cell along with the plasmid will replicate. And if you want to, you can turn the gene on and off, and the gene can be transcribed and translated. So what you end up with then is a whole bunch of bacterial cells with a whole bunch of plasmids in them, which have got the gene that you want to have to be copied inside it. And if you've switched that gene on, that gene is then producing millions or trillions of copies of the protein that it encodes for. And then in fact, you can isolate that protein, and you've just got a whole bunch of that protein. So why is that useful? Well, the most classic example of that use is the production of the human protein insulin. So if you're diabetic, you don't really have much insulin. So what we can do is in these big, basically, I think they use yeast, but these big factories with these little single-celled organisms, we put our gene for insulin in a bit of plasmid DNA, put it inside the yeast. That DNA is then replicated millions of times. We can turn the gene on, which produces insulin. We isolate it, we put it in little vials, and then diabetics can inject it and be able to live with their diabetes. So gene cloning is a pretty super use of science. Another super duper important scientific technique, which is used by geneticists all the time, is a technique called the polymerase chain reaction. Now, it's normally actually just referred to as PCR. So PCR is used to amplify DNA. So that is, make more copies of a particular sequence of DNA. So in fact, it can amplify the amount of DNA from a tiny sample, even just one single copy of DNA, to a very large amount, like a million copies of that particular DNA sequence within a few short hours. It's particularly useful in scientific techniques like DNA fingerprinting or DNA sequencing, as well as lots of other things. Now, just like when DNA is replicated in your cell, the process relies on an enzyme called DNA polymerase. But in PCR, the DNA polymerase is actually, it's actually called TAC polymerase. And that's because the special DNA polymerase used in PCR has been isolated from a special bacteria called Thermus aquaticus. And Thermus aquaticus is a species of bacteria that can live in particularly high temperatures. So, it can tolerate high temperatures, and so therefore the enzymes like DNA polymerase found in Thermus aquaticus don't denature at high temperatures. So the PCR reaction relies on this special DNA polymerase enzyme called TAC polymerase. So PCR basically involves a three-step process, and the three steps are repeated over and over and over and over again, because at each step the DNA is duplicated, you know, replicated, and then you do the three steps and it's replicated, and do the three steps and it's duplicated and duplicated and duplicated and duplicated, so that each time you do the three steps, you know, you get double the amount of DNA, which results in this exponential growth in the number of copies of the DNA sequence of interest. So the three steps are basically, the first step is you denature the double-stranded section of DNA, which you're interested in amplifying, and you need to heat the DNA to about 94 degrees for this to happen. So that's a key point as to why you need to use TAC polymerase, because obviously if you heated, you know, human DNA polymerase to 94 degrees Celsius, it would denature and then wouldn't work anymore. So it's important that you use TAC polymerase. So yeah, you denature the double-stranded DNA, you then bind these two primer sequences of DNA to the specific region of DNA that you want to amplify, and this is, you do this at about 55 degrees for a couple of minutes, so the primers bind to the ends of the DNA sequence that you want to amplify. So the third step, so you've got the denaturation and then the annealing step, the third step is an extension step. And in this step, basically, the TAC polymerase synthesizes a new DNA strand complementary to the DNA template which you're after. And this occurs at a temperature of about 72 degrees for about a minute. And then you start again. So you then denature again. So you had one copy of DNA. You then denatured, annealed, and then extended to get two copies of double-stranded DNA. If you denature, anneal, and extend again, you get four copies of double-stranded DNA. Denature, anneal, extend again, you get 8 copies, and then 16, and then 32, and then 64, and then so on and so forth. And in fact, after a relatively short number of cycles, you can end up with, you know, a million or millions of copies of the DNA sequence that you're interested in. So that's PCR, and that's a super duper important technique for geneticists. Now, another amazing gene technology is the ability of geneticists to introduce genes from one species into a different species. So they do this, you know, for a whole bunch of reasons. For example, you can introduce genes for pest resistance into plants. Anytime you introduce a gene from one species into another organism, that organism is then referred to as a transgenic organism. And now, before you start thinking, fantastic, I'm going to go and play God and I'm going to create my own genetically modified organism, in Australia at least, if you do ever want to create a transgenic organism, you have to get approval from some government committees, and only once you've got approval from these committees can you go on and carry on with your research. So not anyone can just go around creating transgenic organisms, but they can be particularly useful for, you know, crops and increasing crop yields. So DNA technology is clearly useful for farmers, but it's also very useful in medicine too. In particular, it's useful in prenatal testing, as well as testing, you know, so prenatal testing for disease genes by and large, but also it can test for disease genes later in life. A couple of good examples of these is the detection of haemophilia. So basically, you can tell if someone's got haemophilia by testing for a restriction fragment length polymorphism, or RFLP. So basically, if you have the haemophilia gene, you have an extra restriction enzyme cut site within the DNA of a particular gene, and if you don't have haemophilia, or you don't have the haemophilia allele of the gene, then you don't have that cut site. So if you can isolate a bit of DNA from some people, test to see if they've got that restriction fragment cut site, then you can find out whether or not they've got the haemophilia gene, or, you know, whether they're homozygous for it or heterozygous for it, or they don't have it at all. Now, scientists can also use DNA technology to test for Huntington's disease, but because Huntington's disease is actually a late onset disease, normally the test occurs before the people have the disease, so it's actually called predictive testing. So you can test a person's DNA to see if they're likely to get Huntington's disease in the future. And the test is basically looking for a trinucleotide repeat, or a number of trinucleotide repeats. So a trinucleotide repeat is three nucleotides, in this case C, A, and G, repeated over and over and over. So if you're not at risk of Huntington's disease, you'll have about 6 to 30 of these trinucleotide repeats. So let's say you've got 6, you'll have a bit of DNA in the Huntington disease gene, and it'll go CAG, 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 CAG. But if you are at risk of Huntington's disease, you'll have, you know, 40 or 50 copies of that trinucleotide repeat, one after the other. And so we check to see the numbers of trinucleotide repeats and to see if a person is going to be, you know, going to get Huntington's disease in the future. And you can also, because you can do this predictive testing, what some people do is if they're you know, engaging in IVF or in vitro fertilization. You can take one cell of a blastocyst, so the newly formed, you know, organism, one of the stem cells of that organism, you can take that one cell of a blastocyst out and genetically analyze that cell for, you know, Huntington's disease or whatever disease you're particularly concerned about. And that can decide whether or not the female gets that particular fertilized egg implanted into her uterus or not. So obviously if in IVF you test one of the fertilized eggs and you find it's got a disease, you don't implant that egg into your uterus and you don't get pregnant with a person who's going to end up having a disease, which is pretty amazing. Now the next thing I'd like to talk about is DNA profiling. So DNA profiling is basically a way to identify someone based on their DNA or compare someone to different people based on their DNA. And it's got a whole bunch of different uses. So it can be used in forensics. So for example, forensic scientists can go to a crime scene, get a sample of, you know, some tissue or blood, go back to the lab and then compare that to a, you know, DNA database and be able to find out exactly whose blood it belonged to. DNA profiling can be used in paternity testing. So you can get a DNA, a blood sample from, you know, a few different males and, you know, then an offspring, and you can find out whose father the offspring is. It can be used in gene hunting. So that is trying to find, you know, a disease gene. So for example, that's used if you get a group of people who have a disease and you look at their DNA, and then you get a group of people who haven't got a disease and look at their DNA, you might be able to find a difference, and that difference might head you or lead you in the right direction to find a disease gene. So yeah, DNA profiling's got a whole bunch of different uses. Now, DNA profiling works by analyzing a bunch of short tandem repeats or microsatellites across a person's or a bunch of different people's genomes. So a short tandem repeat or a microsatellite is a short tandem repeat. So what that means is that it's a short, very short sequence of DNA, you know, 2, 3, 4 base pairs long, but it's repeated over and over again. So this is kind of like those trinucleotide repeats I spoke about earlier. So you can get dinucleotide repeats, so which is, you know, 2 base pairs repeated over and over and over again. So, you know, AT, 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 and different people will have different numbers of repeats. You can get a trinucleotide repeat, so, you know, GCA, 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 GCA. You can get a tetranucleotide repeat, so TAAT, 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 TAAT. You get the idea. So there's these short tandem repeats, and they're repeated many times in a particular stretch of DNA. But the number of repeats at each location, at each microsatellite location, is different between different people. So I might have in my genome, I might have a dinucleotide repeat, which is, you know, 2 base pairs of DNA, and it's repeated maybe 44 times. So that length of my DNA would be 88 base pairs long. But you might have the same microsatellite region in your DNA. Your dinucleotide repeat may only be repeated 40 times. So that the length of your DNA at that spot would only be 80 base pairs long. So what scientists can do is that they can, using PCR in fact, they can amplify up that little patch of DNA and then check to see how big it is. And when they do that, if they looked at my DNA, they'd see that my microsatellite, or, you know, my little short tandem repeat area, would be 88 base pairs long, and yours might be 80 base pairs long, and different people will have totally different numbers of repeats. And there's also, you know, hundreds and hundreds of microsatellite regions. So what you can do is you can pick a bunch of different little microsatellites along the genome, and then look to see how big each microsatellite is, so how many repeats there are at each little microsatellite region, and compare that to a bunch of different people, and that's a way to, you know, identify someone's DNA. And that brings episode 35 of the VCE Biology Podcast to a close. I'm Mr. Barlow, and thanks for listening.